This is Specific Objects, Talks on Art in the Catskills, and I'm your host, Miriam Atkin. Today, I'm delighted to have with me composer and performer Leah Bertucci.
Hello.
But before we begin, I'm going to say a few words about the WGXC Winter Pledge Drive, which is happening now, with the goal of bringing in new members and reaching $5,000 in monthly support. I am a brand new programmer here. This is only the second episode of my show. And in these couple months, working with a WGXC crew and learning the ropes of independent radio, I've gotten a real sense of why stations like this are so important. They make an incredible array of perspectives and formats possible. In one sitting, I've heard broadcasts ranging from commentary on local politics to wildly experimental transmission art, and this range represents to me the bizarre beauty of the Hudson Valley so perfectly. If you get as much pleasure as I do from this colorful palette that is WGXC, please do consider helping us out at wgxc.org/donate. New local monthly supporters will receive thank you gifts, including WGXC tote bags, t-shirts, and sweatshirts. I encourage you all to show your love with a donation, or if you can't do that, call the feedback line at 518-212-7509 and leave a message about your experience as a listener and why you appreciate the station. All right. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce Leah Bertucci. Leah is a Kingston-based artist, composer, and performer whose work describes relationships between acoustic phenomena and biological resonance. In addition to her long-standing practice with woodwind instruments, her work incorporates multi-channel speaker arrays, radical methods of free improvisation, and creative misuses of audio technology. In recent years, her projects have expanded toward site-specific and site-responsive sonic investigations of architecture and acoustics. Her discography spans over a decade, with 8 releases of full-length solo albums and a number of collaborative projects. She has performed extensively across the U.S. and Europe with presenters such as the Museum of Modern Art, New York, Gagosian Gallery, The Kitchen, Museo Reina Sofia Madrid, and the Sound of Stockholm Festival, to just name a few. Leah Bertucci, it's great to be talking to you today.
Thanks, Miriam.
So the first time I heard you play was, I think it was during the height of the pandemic, in the parking lot of TSL in Hudson. And you were in Bobby Previtt's ensemble. You were improvising on saxophone, I believe.
Right.
And then a little later, I saw your sound installation on Harvey Fite's sculpture in Opus 40, which was pretty wildly different than what I had seen you doing with Bobby Previtt. And so I'm just wondering, like, what was the tree that all of these branches originally grew from? Did you start off playing saxophone or other instruments? What was it?
Yeah, I would say that I started off as an instrumentalist, for sure. I'm a product of a public school band, and so I played saxophone from the age of 9, and I was really into jazz and classical music for, you know, growing up, and eventually, when I was in college, I got exposed to more radical forms of electronic music. So I started using electronics with my saxophone around that time. And then from there, it's just kind of expanded outwards. And I've started to do installations and writing for other instruments and electronics and field recording and all sorts of different things.
Do you happen to have a specific memory of the first time you heard music that was as abstract and non-melodic in any conventional sense as the work that you make now? And what that was like and what kind of switch it turned on in you.
Yeah, I would say that the first like weird music that I heard was free jazz. And that was because when I was in high school, I worked at this vegetarian free jazz cafe that no longer exists, sadly, in Rosendale, New York, called the Rosendale Cafe. And at the time, they were having shows of like downtown jazz, free jazz, and bluegrass and folk and stuff like that. And so, you know, I was like 16 years old and I saw Joe McPhee play and a bunch of other people doing like radical jazz. And, you know, it's, I didn't really like it very much at the time because I mean, I was into like, I was getting into John Coltrane and stuff like that, but it was still like a notch above in like challenging, you know? So I couldn't quite get with it at the time. But anytime I am not really sure that I like something, I'm kind of interested in it. It becomes like a point of fascination to me of like, why, like, what is it about this thing that is like, you know, sticking in my mind. And I would definitely say that a lot of the sounds that I encountered through working at the Rosendale Cafe and, yeah, seeing what they were putting on, stayed with me in this way. You know, later when I went to, Bard, I, you know, got more into like electronic noise music and stuff like that. That was kind of prevalent at the time in like the early 2000s. So, yeah, I would say that probably when I was like a teenager was the first time I encountered that music, but it didn't, it wasn't like my amazing new fascination.
Right.
I was a little skeptical of it.
Yeah. I remember being in my early 20s living in Buffalo, and there was this venue that, you know, was known for its program of experimental music, which I was not into. And I saw a few shows in which, to me, it was just someone behind a laptop, like, generating these really quiet, boring sounds. And I hated it. And then Tatsuya Nakatani played there one night. And it was, like, the noisiest thing that I'd ever seen and the wildest thing that I'd ever seen. And I was just totally captivated. And,
Amazing.
Yeah, and then later I saw Butch Morris, the Butch Morris Ensemble, which was also like one of the weirdest things that I'd ever seen. And seeing people engage with their instruments physically in this way was so fascinating to me. And it sparked that kind of, I don't know what you call it, like mirror neuron response or something that made it was like physically so exciting. But that was, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I didn't end up playing the music. I just continued to appreciate it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think for me, because like I played saxophone, it was already in the realm of like understanding about like using your instrument, but I didn't really understand that you could use your instrument in this way.
Right.
You know, I was used to playing little nice melodies and stuff like that. I was never thinking timbrally, you know, of like what sounds can I make from this instrument? Because that's like not part of the, you know, pedagogy. That's not how you like learn how to do music. So, yeah, I mean, I've also felt frustrated by the like very kind of anemic laptop performance. I think it just depends on who it is. You know, I think in any genre with any process, there can be people who do it in like amazing ways and then people who do it in less amazing ways. So, you know, it's just,
I don't mean to disparage that kind of performance because now I don't have a prejudice against it like I used to because I have more of an understanding of what might be going on.
Right. And how to like listen to that music.
Yeah, I imagine that discovery that you had, that like your sort of musical explorations could include this, I don't know, investigation of timbre instead of being hamstrung by the by the melody. I imagine that must have felt really good.
Yeah, I mean, it just kind of like expanded my ideas of what's possible.
Yeah.
Like what range of things are possible to express and how to be like creative and inventive with the music rather than just like replicating historical music.
Right. And so when was that happening mostly while you were at Bard?
Yeah, I'd say so. And it's funny because also while I was at Bard, I kind of stopped playing music for a couple years. I was a visual, or I was a photography major there. So I was more engaged in like visual disciplines. And I think it was important to for me to like have that break because I stopped playing like jazz music. I started listening to like weirder stuff and getting more involved in like radical forms of, you know, just learning about like performance art and video art and like, you know, all sorts of other experimental forms.
I want to ask who some of the composers were that were inspiring you then, but I'm also interested in who were some of the non-musical visual artists that somehow, like their approach to making work somehow influenced how you ended up making music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think the one of the big discoveries for me around that time, I took a history of experimental cinema class, and I learned about like Stan Brakhage, Maya Deren, Harry Smith, experimental cinema people, and that really blew my mind. And that I would say is probably one of the bigger influences on how things kind of turned out for me. I think there's a lot of affinity between experimental music and experimental film for like a bunch of different reasons. You know, both time-based mediums, dealing in like non-narrative kind of forms, thinking, you know, texturally, timbrally, messing with notions of time, all of these types of things, I think, you know, had a big impact on how I thought of what music could do.
Yeah, now that you say that and having listened to some of your recent work, I'm trying to think about what filmmakers I would name alongside them.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'll come up with it by the end of our conversation. But I do feel that there is a cinematic dimension to your work, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and since we're talking about your history, and because we're having this conversation during the WGXC Winter Pledge Drive, I want to bring up the fact that you were a Wave Farm resident many moons ago, and I just wanted to ask you what that was like.
Yeah, so I did a residency there. And I might be misremembering the year, but I'm going to say it was like 2009, maybe. And this was before they had built the study center and when it was really just kind of Tom and Galen's property that they allowed artists to come and like stay in their cabin for a few weeks at a time. But I had known them a little bit before from Free 103 days back in the city. I think we played at their loft like once when it was in South Williamsburg. And yeah, so I mean, they were just, and you know, keep in mind, I was 23 at the time, maybe 24. And so they were really early supporters of, you know, what I was doing. And I think it's really important to have people like that who are, you know, allowing folks to come up and experiment and just have time and space to work. And they've really done an amazing thing with that organization, building it out the way that they have from like pretty humble beginnings. So I think that, you know, continuing to nurture the growth of those types of organizations is like really crucial because, you know, it's where young artists and also established artists have like a haven to come and experiment and create.
Yeah. And I'm also impressed by the kind of variety of platforms or kind of ways of circulating one's work that Wave Farm and WGXC make possible. I mean, the installations on the grounds at Wave Farm and the performances. I mean, the Galen and Tom collaborate with different concert venues around the Hudson Valley and Catskills to kind of share programming that is produced during the residencies. And then there's like obviously the broadcast element. And yeah, I mean, it's really that dimension of it is very special. And I've never really encountered anything like it.
It's a very special and unique place. Yes. For sure. There isn't anything that is quite that up here. So yep. Yeah.
If you're just tuning in, this is Specific Objects, Talks on Art in the Catskills. I'm your host, Miriam Atkin, and here in the studio with me is Kingston-based composer Lia Bertucci. I think this would be a good time to pivot to the work itself. Mm-hmm. And so I'd like to play a couple excerpts from your latest album release, which is called Shadow and Substance. Of Shadow and Substance. And it was put out in late 2023 by your label, Cybachrome Editions. The album consists of two long tracks, and we'll listen to excerpts from both tracks. The first track is called Vapors, and it was a piece that was commissioned and performed by Italy's Quartetto Maurice.
Yes, and it premiered in 2021 at their festival called Musica in Prossimita in the north of Italy, and it's for string quartet and electronics.
Thank you.
And this is from the second track, which is the titular track of the album. And it was commissioned by the Philadelphia Creative Foundation Ars Nova Workshop and performed by Henry Fraser, Lester St. Louis, Lucia Stavros, and Matt Evans. If you're just tuning in, this is Specific Objects, Talks on Art in the Catskills. I'm your host, Miriam Atkin. Here in the studio with me is Kingston-based composer Lia Bertucci, and we're discussing her latest album release of Shadow and Substance. So to start, I'm aware from the liner notes that the album uses just intonation, and this may not be an easy task, but I'm wondering if you can maybe explain what that is in layman's terms.
Yeah. So it's actually just the first piece. The string quartet is tuned in just intonation. It's basically like an older tuning system that goes back. So like most Western classical or like Western music in general is tuned to what we call equal temperament. And that's something that came around kind of like after Bach. And it gives us, you know, like the scale, the chromatic scale, the major scale, 12-tone music. It's just like a way of dividing tones. So just intonation is an older system that goes back to Pythagoras. So the idea of just intonation is that it's using the natural resonances of like a string, for example. A string, when you pluck it, has different harmonic nodes at which it sounds, and those would be the notes of the scale. So when you're tuning in just, it sounds a little bit to like a Western ear, a little bit more dissonant. I think it sounds more magical. I think that it sounds more in line with natural processes. It's used by a lot of amazing, you know, people over the years, Tony Conrad, Lamont Young, Catherine Lamb is, you know, another example. So it's, yeah, it's just like a way to get, you know, I figured if I was going to write a string quartet, which is like such a Western classical form, that I should maybe try a different tuning system so it doesn't sound too normal, I guess.
Do you see that ancientness of just intonation as somehow significant to this piece's particular vision?
Definitely. So the title of the piece is like, it has like a double meaning. It's an archaic spelling of the word vapors. So in like arcane medical terminology, it's a way to diagnose so-called hysteria, usually in women. And a vapor also has, you know, like a fluid mechanics connotation where it's, you know, the moment when a molecule is moving from a liquid to a gaseous state. So it's just like this moment of transition, of instability, of change. So, you know, both of those things have long and strange histories. So, yeah, I think that using the just intonation is more than like an aesthetic thing. It also is part of what I was going for in the piece, creating a sense of eternity, of timelessness, of like peering back sort of into history and into human experience.
Yeah, when I... when I listened to it, I was listening to it on SoundCloud, and you have that visualization. And so, you know, you can see that there's this moment about, I think, 2/3 of the way through where the amplitude just builds into this I don't know, this peak or a mountain or...
A storm is how I call it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it felt like the piece was... It was an event. The piece was about an event. That's what it felt to me. I didn't know what the event was. I didn't necessarily have an image attached to it, but it was an event that had a before and after. And the before is very well articulated during the first 2/3 of the piece. And then there's an after. And it feels that storm is so kind of like earth shattering that it's almost this moment where when you're in it, it feels like a apocalyptic. But then there's always this afterword. There's this poem by John Giorno, and it's the Suicide Sutra. Are you familiar with that?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And it's really amazing because it's this long the recording of him reading this poem is kind of widely available, and that's how I've accessed it, was via the recording. But it's this long poem that's narrating a suicide, and it's like, you know, there's quite a few minutes before the suicide moment happens, and then you just assume that it's going to end with the suicide. But then it goes on for another, you know, 10 minutes or something after the suicide, and there's something that's so both like terrifying and beautiful about that, because I'm just thinking about what I think this piece is meditating on, these cycles of life and death. And there's always something that's kind of, we imagine that we are liberated by these various endings that we might have access to, like I can end this life if I don't want it anymore, but there's always, I mean, there's something afterwards. And I'm not talking about an afterlife. I'm talking about like whatever happens on a molecular level to my body when I die. But just like there's something that's very important to that, like what happens after. And I really found myself fully immersed in that moment in a very contemplative kind of way.
Yeah, I mean, time goes on.
Yeah.
And actions, there are, I think this is kind of like a unifying theme between the first two tracks, or the two tracks of the record, is that like this idea that actions have resonances that extend far into the future. So dealing with like time and structure in this way. Yeah, it's just a way of contemplating that stuff. And I would say definitely like the first track that we listened to, Vapors, is more on the contemplative side of things in this way. And then the second track is more of like an accumulation of actions. And that's also facilitated by the electronics in the piece. So what the electronics in the second piece, the title track of Shadow and Substance, which is a Twilight Zone reference, were wondering.
Is it the name of an episode?
It's in Rod Serling's opening monologue at the end. Uh-huh. Or I think it's at the end. He says this phrase of Shadow and Substance. Oh. And I think it's very beautiful, and I'm a lifelong Twilight Zone fan.
Yeah.
So that's part of where it came from. But so in the second track of Shadow and Substance, the ensemble plays for, 20 minutes, and their sounds are with electronics being discreetly looped and layered over themselves. And so at the end, it's kind of this diffused accumulation. And so when the piece is performed live, everybody slowly puts down their instruments and their sounds kind of hang in the air through like a four-channel sound system. So it kind of speaks to the way that like the accumulation of events over time can leave like a haze behind it. And just like, yeah, events from the past propelling themselves into the present and into the future.
So when the piece is performed, are you on stage, or the electronics are all being manipulated by the four performers?
No, I'm the one that is manipulating the electronics. The electronics are really simple.
Yeah.
It's just a granular synthesis patch.
Mm-hmm.
And in the second piece, it's the granular synthesis patch plus the looping. And that's controlled by me. And I'm either usually off to the side on stage, or I'll be like in the mixing desk, like in the sound booth. So I'm kind of like sometimes on stage, sometimes not.
I guess, I can ask this about your work in general, but specifically with regard to these pieces, the kind of sensation or set of images that the pieces do evoke, which of course will differ from person to person, but however, whatever you see them evoking, is it something that you have in mind and then you craft the piece around it, or do those things emerge from the time of performance and then somehow you're able to have a perception of them and then maybe enhance them in post-production? Or
it's different for everything I do. Sometimes I'll set out with an idea and I stick pretty closely to the idea and I execute it. Usually that's stuff that is like in my wheelhouse of things that I've done before and I know will kind of work. These I haven't written that many ensemble pieces. So every time I compose for other instruments, it's really a different thing than when I'm, composing for music that I'm performing myself. For me, the process is like I start out with ideas, pretty abstract ideas of what I want something to sound like. Usually it's like based in the sounds of like, oh, I want to try this technique on the double bass and then this thing happening in percussion. And like, let's see what happens when we make those sounds together. So the process that I use to compose is that I'll work with musicians one-on-one and I'll have like an array of, ideas that we kind of like improvise with and, record and play. And then I'll take those recordings home and like listen to them and meditate on them and obsess over them for a while. And then I'll kind of like craft some, juxtapositions, some layers of things, and then I'll go back and rehearse with the ensemble and try out different things and then record that and then see what is the most, like what moves me the most. And then in the process of, you know, recording and rehearsing and working with people, I sort of figure out what the piece is really about. And sometimes it's like revealed to me a little late in the process. Yeah. But like with the string quartet, for example, you know, I gave them notes and, you know, pages and pages of notation and things. And I think we ended up using about 3 out of like 11 pages that I had written.
Hmm.
And so it was really a question of peeling away the layers of the onion to see what is the least amount of stuff that I can get the most amount out of.
Yeah.
And I think that was kind of the right approach for that. It felt like not too forced.
Right. Yeah. I wanted to ask you about notation, and I know that you're about to, correct me if I'm wrong, go to Mexico to teach a workshop on graphic notation. And so maybe talk a little bit about your notation practice and maybe what kinds of things you're going to delve into during the workshop.
Yeah, so the workshop is a 10-session masterclass at MUAC, the Museum of Contemporary Art in Mexico City. And so it's a deep dive into different approaches to graphic score or just non-traditional music notation. And I'll be showing a lot of historical examples, and then we'll be doing drawing exercises, and then we'll be playing. We'll have people coming up with graphic scores, and then we'll play them. Mm. So, yeah, it should be really fun. I think that, you know, when you're dealing with non-traditional musical techniques, it calls for an expanded form of notation that's off of the staff. I really like the idea that my scores look the way that they sound. And you know, this is probably just like part of my like synesthesia or my like practice as a visual artist, that drawing is an important part of like how I express musical ideas. And sometimes I use staff notation, sometimes not. It really depends. There's also a lot of different types of approaches to graphic scores. There's like the completely interpretive approach, like Cornelius Cardew's treatise is like, you know, the prime example of this, where it's open to complete, open interpretation, open instrumentation, and really it can sound like anything. Mm-hmm. And that's the radical gesture is one of interpretation. For my scores, I tend to be a little bit more specific in what sounds I want people to make, but because I incorporate improvisation to some degree, it's like controlled improvisation where I'm giving people like a set of musical techniques to play with, and then I want them to play with each other, basically. So trying to create spaces where people are not like having to fastidiously read the score. And are able to like open themselves up to actually like listening to what's going on within the ensemble while the music is happening. That's kind of like what I'm more interested in, is like a suggestive form of notation.
Hmm. If you're just tuning in, this is Specific Objects, Talks on Art in the Catskills. I'm your host, Miriam Atkin, and here in the studio with me is Kingston-based composer Lia Bertucci. So in the last few minutes of our conversation, I'd love to give the audience a glimpse of the kind of range of work that you do. And you have an album that's not yet released called I Know the Number of the Sand and the Measure of the Sea. It's very different from the tracks that we just heard. And so I would love to play a clip from that. The album is a collaboration with Olivia Block.
Yep, that's right. And it'll be out on a label called Room 40 Shoots this year. And so this record is, Olivia is playing synthesizer and field recordings and tapes. And I'm playing, I'm doing voice with tape and other electronics. So I found this funny process of altering my voice electronically through the use of reel-to-reel tape. So it's kind of like extending, warping, and twisting my voice. And it's a really easy way to improvise.
Hmm. Yeah, let's take a listen. The first thing that struck me when I heard this album is that you have this background in wind instruments, and now you've innovated this kind of instrument that has, or it's a kind of music that's grounded in the movement of the breath.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always found wind instruments to be vulnerable in a certain way, in a kind of unique way, and that, you know, the force of the sound is really dependent on the operation of the body and the internal organs in this way that almost becomes very visible in performance.
Mm-hmm.
And especially hearing you describe your role in the other tracks that we just listened to, the way that you're manipulating the electronics sort of off the side of the stage. So I'm just thinking about this movement between being almost this like invisible Wizard of Oz director figure to having your body and vocal cords and breath center stage.
Yeah, I mean, my background is as a performer, mm-hmm. and as an instrumentalist and a wind player, right? So I've always been pretty attuned to the fact that like my actual life force, like the thing that's keeping me alive, is what is creating like a musical thing. Right. And I always found that really fascinating with playing saxophone and playing wind instruments. The voice, it's really interesting, like transitioning to doing things with my voice. I always had a lot of kind of baggage around my voice. And so it wasn't easy to, you know, start doing that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's actually been like a really liberating thing for me to use my voice, and thinking about, you know, the intimacy of that is something that's actually really powerful. And, you know, if I am being a performer, I might as well really be a performer and be present and have my body be like very much incorporated into what I'm doing. And so I think using voice even more so maybe somehow is doing that. I think, you know, and this gets back to just having like a diverse kind of practice. It's really nice to sometimes have other people be the performers.
Yeah.
You know, and it comes with its own set of anxieties, because, you know, I don't have as much control over what happens in the performance, but it also has its own form of liberation where I can just kind of like stand back and, you know, put trust in other people that they're going to like do what needs to be done. So, I mean, it's just, you know, being a musician, there's so many different parts of it, right? There's like the studio practice where I'm alone in my space and I'm listening to stuff and I'm making things by myself. Then there's like the collaboration where I'm like touring with people or collaborating in like groups. And then, you know, recording versus playing live. And, you know, there's just like so many parts of the practice that you can get into. And so to me, not being on stage is just another way in which like music is a really diverse kind of discipline.
So to wrap up, I guess I want to just ask you what you have coming up. Are there any upcoming projects or performances you want to mention?
I guess, you know, the next thing that I'm doing is the Mexico City thing. I'll be performing there at Casa del Lago on the 20th. So if anyone in the Hudson Valley is going to be in Mexico City in the next couple of weeks, come hang out. And then the record with Olivia will be out later in the summer. And yeah, I don't know. That's kind of what's going on.
Well, thanks for talking with me. It's been a real delight.
Thanks, Miriam.
Thank you.